Welcome to Poetry in the Air, a Right Attitude radio show. This program is brought to you by the Office of the Quality Enhancement Plan. The Right Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative that enhances student learning by fostering positive attitudes toward writing. I am your host, Didi Botticelli. Today's show will focus on poems, prose, and authors featured in Estuary, Savannah State University's student-run literary journal. We will hear critically acclaimed poets such as Sajana McCrae, Shirley Wolpe, Maria Hadessa Ekeritali, and Noah Blaustein. Also, we will listen to an interview with Sajana McCrae, conducted by Dr. Chad Ferries, editor of Estuary and associate professor of English and creative writing at Savannah State University. During the second half of the show, we'll hear poetry and prose written and read by Savannah State students. Let's start by hearing the poems of Shirley Wolpe and Noah Blaustein. These acclaimed poets, featured in the Georgia Poetry Circuit, visited Savannah State University in 2015. Both Wolpe and Blaustein met with creative writing students and gave poetry readings. The events were free and open to Savannah State University members and the local community.
The Scar Saloon. The red sign posted on the window reads, "Women only. Show scar to the attendant." And the old woman stands by the double doors, turning away anyone who can't show a respectable mark. The only scar I have is from a C-section. Still, the old gal opens, lets me in. A young woman with long hair and apple martini in hand sits beside me, throws me a casual glance, then asks to see my scar. Timidly, I unzip my pants, reveal the brown wrinkled line. She looks at it, nods, sips her drink, then unbuttons her blouse and shows me a dark gap where her left breast used to be. I don't know what to say. I want to apologize, but the woman quickly buttons up and says, "It could be you. Besides, I'd rather lose a breast than a child." The gray head on the next bar stool blinks, her bulging eyes, color of wilted weeds. She pulls down her black velvet skirt, her white cotton underwear, points to her cesarean scar from navel to curly pubic hair. "Cyclops," she says. "The inquirer wanted pictures." I said no. "I have no business here. A scar isn't a dead, forgotten twig. It's a branch with living roots snaking through veins. A scar has a tongue. It has a story." I turn to leave and bump into a small woman who smiles. Her cheeks are hollow, her lips timid. A razor cut deep from hairline into down slanted eye is like a jagged road carved deep on icy snow. I step out of the saloon, the mark on my flesh, singing.
My name is Candace Reynolds, and I'll be reading On Our Way to My Mother's. Police cars well by, two ambulances, then a tow truck, in that center of me where blood is thick, stills like a pond waiting for a pebble. I dial Alex's mobile until voicemail, hang up, dial again, hang up. My cheekbones throb, a ghost voice hiccups inside my ears. "That is your son. They are rushing to. His small infinity crushed like a can of Coke." My windows are rolled up and the air conditioning blows into my armpits. I keep to the slow lane, ready to jump out, push off the police. The emergency crew reach my son's precious body, stretched out, 6'6", on the hot asphalt, his shirt blushing with his blood. Mine. This life I gave 24 years ago, now slipping away to elsewhere, to another mother perhaps, giving birth with joyful streaks among Saturn's rings. I see myself cradle his dark, heavy head in my arms, stroke his big curls gently, and streak too. Later we sit eating at my mother's roasted lamb, grilled tomatoes, and her bowls of cool rose-scented pudding. Alex's face flashing into the sun-starved room as he tells us about his new job at NASA, the girl from Romania he is dating, the apartment downtown he wants to rent, the life he imagines he will live forever.
You've just listened to poems written by Iranian poet, writer, editor, and literary translator Shirley Wolpe. The Scar Saloon was read by Shirley Wolpe. And On Our Way to My Mother's was read by SSU student Candace Reynolds.
bedtime stories. I'm going to flower you with my whip. I'm going to stick you for dinner and moss you for dessert. I'm your Gruffalo, your Gremlin, your Grinch. If your tongue is hot, drink milk. Yes, I made the mountain out of moonlight. A star has fallen in the front yard. Poke your eyes open, and I'll return it. After party. The Hello Kitty pinata head swings from the pepper tree. A sweet decapitation. Glitter across the rental table and pink paper flowers in the succulents. Icing and wrapping paper on the coffee table. This is the stale beer and cigarettes of seven-year-olds. My fluffy puppy is so soft. Still means my fluffy puppy is so soft. And this is the best birthday ever. Still means this is the best birthday ever. I'm seducing my wife, showing her I can still wrestle a woolly mammoth the way 40-something-year-old men of my generation do, by separating blue and red sticky things, taking out cake plate trash. I'm celebrating their lack of cool, no fights over girls or boys to save face, just face paint, just little leopards everywhere.
You listen to Bedtime Stories and After Party, poems written and read by critically acclaimed poet Noah Blaustein. These poems are featured in Estuary, Savannah State University's literary magazine. Estuary publishes the work of students and acclaimed artists from local, national, and international communities. What is an estuary, you may ask? An estuary is that part of a river's mouth where its current meets the sea's tide, and sweet inland water is mixed with briny seawater. Savannah State University sits on such an estuary. Listen to a writing tip of the day, please, and I will be back with more poetry just for you.
I'm Dr. Lisa Yaunt, the director of the Right Attitude Program at Savannah State University. Here's the writing tip of the day.
I am Deanne Goins, a professional writing tutor at the SSU Writing Center, and I bring you the Right Attitude Writing Tip of the Day. Commas are used to separate two independent clauses when a coordinated conjunction is present.
The Right Attitude Writing Tip of the Day is brought to you by the SSU Writing Center and the Office of the Quality Enhancement Plan. The Right Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative to enhance student learning by improving attitudes about writing. Visit the SSU Writing Center in Payne Hall to get assistance with your writing projects, and to learn more about how you can improve your writing attitudes and skills, visit qep.savannahstate.edu.
Welcome back. I am your host, Didi Botticelli. Now I invite you to listen to poet Maria Hadessa Ekeretali, another special guest of Savannah State University. Besides giving a poetry reading, Ekeri led a very creative poetry workshop for Savannah State University students.
Letter 8. Dear Continuum, I hope all is well. As you can see by the postcard, I am in Bahia. This is a sojourn I've wanted to make for well over a decade. Touching this soil feels like a reunion. I brought your letter here with me. The urgency in your questions made me do that. Writing feels urgent, and it is urgent. But this idea of getting it right creates a pressure that does not seem to serve. What does it mean to get it right? Right according to who? I experience the process of writing in many different ways. Sometimes it's like channeling. Other times it's a rite of passage. Often writing is a conversation between the poem and me, between me and me, between the events of the world and my responses to them, between people I love and me. When is a poem finished? I know a poem is finished much like I know a good conversation is over. I find myself sitting comfortably in silence. Everything that needed saying has been said. My words are like windows wiped down with distilled vinegar. My meaning is clear. Sometimes truths I don't consciously know reveal themselves during the writing process. I've got to be open to those truths. Again, it's like being in conversation. I have to hear everything being said to me, and I can't plan another's words, so I have to listen. When I'm writing, sometimes everything stops. It's as though I'm being handed words. When they land in my palm, I sift through them carefully. I turn the words over and over, study them as intently as I would a potential lover's eyes. It's a delicate, powerful motion. These unnamed things within step tentatively into the light, and the words that I am given either become their names or wait until I wrestle with something truer from the invisible. For me, the end of the poem is signaled by silence. Then the sounds of the voices around me, my hunger, my thirst, or the rumble of the subway become audible again. Some poems end with an explosion, and some end with a whisper. But when a poem has done its job, it never ends. It stays with the reader or the listener long after the last line. Love, Mariah Dessa. Letter 14. Dear Continuum, do I think suffering is a prerequisite for great artistry? No, I don't. What I think is that most people suffer at some point. The artist just dares to admit it. I think awareness, empathy, strong observation skills, and the ability to listen deeply are necessary tools for any artist. Wisdom, coupled with the ability to admit that you really don't know much of anything, are also instruments that will help you shape your art. Do you ever listen to the blues? If not, I recommend you dip your toes in the sounds of Big Mama Thornton, Bessie Smith, Ida Cox, Howling Wolf, Leadbelly, and Sunhouse. In Uses of the Blues, James Baldwin writes that the blues contains the toughness that manages to make our experiences articulate. The blues is a testimony to our survival, strength, beauty, ugly, and humor. It's a map, and the mere singing of it is the key. To navigate this sometimes rocky terrain of life, we have to tell our stories. In that same essay, Baldwin writes, "You don't know what the river is like or what the ocean is like by standing on the shore. You can't know anything about life and suppose you can get through it clean." Let me know what you think this means. Continuum, when life is everything that the movies told you it would be, write. When life threatens to shatter you and rip your illusions to shreds, write. When you are distracted by romance, write. When you are consumed by heartache, write. When you are rejoicing, grieving, questioning, certain, write. Life itself will give you a chance to feel everything. I've never set a fire to feel flames singe me. I already know flames will come. So will water. Love, Mariah Dessa.
You have just listened to poems written and read by poet, educator, and poetry editor Maria Hadessa Ekeretali. Now, join me while we listen to an interview conducted by Dr. Chad Ferries, editor of Estuary and associate professor of English and creative writing at Savannah State University. Dr. Ferries speaks with poet Sajana McCrae to learn more about his literary career. Sajana McCrae, poet and Savannah State University faculty member, is the recipient of the 2015 Walt Whitman Award, the nation's most valuable first book prize for poetry.
This is Chad Ferries, talking from Payne Hall at Savannah State University with Sajana McCrae. Did I say your first name right?
Yes, Sajana? That's Sajana.
And Sajana has recently won the Walt Whitman Award, an award offered for a first book by the Academy of American Poets, probably one of the most prestigious first book awards in the country. And it was a big surprise to us all because he stays pretty low-key and never told me that he was a poet. And so we're real happy that he's part of the SSU family, and we're happy to talk to him. So I thought I would start by maybe just asking you to give us a little knowledge about the roots of poetry in your life, right? When did it all start?
I think, you know, I went to a performing arts high school in Cincinnati, and, you know, I couldn't sing, I couldn't dance, I can't act, but I was actually, I was a visual artist first, and then I took creative writing classes as a minor because I needed a minor. What I found out was that I actually liked writing more, and you know, I just started reading. Like, the teacher gave me James Baldwin and Maya Angelou and Nikki Giovanni. And I started reading those first. And then later on, junior, senior year, I moved on to Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton. And I really sort of was taken by Anne Sexton and the whole idea of confessional poetry. And then, you know, I went to Ohio University and I studied poetry. My first class was with Henri Cole. And I had workshopped a poem and I was really proud of it. And I had come from, and I had won awards in high school, so I had like a chip on my shoulder. And he told me that I was, a pretentious flowery decorator. And so I had to sort of rethink, what I was actually doing. So I stripped down what I was writing and I just stripped out all the excess. And he really, really liked that poem. And so I sort of continued in that vein.
That's great. So that's interesting that you had first sort of a visual arts background. And then you said that you started writing poetry and that appealed to you more. Did you find that you could do more with that medium, or was it?
The way that I usually think about it is that Cincinnati is very sort of racially conservative. And so I felt very quiet in Cincinnati. But when I started writing, I didn't feel quiet at all. I felt like, I don't know, there was just like a power in words that I didn't normally have. Once I could organize my thoughts and organize the words on the paper, you know, I'd started reading stuff in workshop, and, you know, people, there was that moment after you read something and there's that quiet because people are either astonished or they're moved. And I mean, that's like crack, like you just become addicted to it. It's just nice to actually be able to move people. And that's always been a goal, is to move people. Sometimes they, not they, but sometimes, you know, you read things about, not being sentimental in poems, and finding the right balance. And so I try to find the right balance because you really do want to affect people. Like, I just don't, I'm not just putting on a show. Mm-hmm. So,
Do you think that one of these poems that I have here that are, these are going to be published in our, student literary journal? So after you had won the award, I contacted you immediately and I asked you to submit some poems to us, and you did, so I appreciate that. Here they are. I've got In Need of Subtitles, Portrait of My Father as a Young Black Man, Insomniacs, and Type 2. So based on what you just said about walking that line between, like, you know, we're always taught that the sentimental is sort of bad, you want to stay away from that because of the pathos of it all. But at the same time, you do want to somehow maybe wound a little bit, you know, your readers so that they feel that sort of tenderness.
Right.
One of these do that, you think?
Maybe. Sure.
Yeah? Here. Yeah. You choose.
Okay. Let's see. I'll read sort of Portrait of My Father as a Young Black Man. I started like writing this poem when I was living in Chicago. I was probably in my late 30s. And for some reason, I was just angry all the time. You know, whether it was like whatever social event was going on in the news. But I was just angry all the time. And when you're, it just felt like I was sort of invisible. And so I wrote this poem. And then I thought about my father as a young man and maybe that he was angry. James Baldwin, in his essay, Notes of a Native Son, has this section where he talks about in every black person, there's sort of like this this fever, this sort of anger, and you inherit it. It's part of you. It's part of American history. And so this poem is called Portrait of My Father as a Young Black Man. Rage is the language of men, layers of particulates fused. Rage is the wine Father pours to the ground for men whose time has passed. Rage is gripped in the hands, like the neck of a broom held tight. Rage gets stuck in the throat, suppressed. Rage is a promise kept. So it sort of is sort of an answer, or it's sort of saying the same thing as that James Baldwin quote.
Mm-hmm. And it's a short poem.
Yeah.
I've always found short poems really challenging, actually. Much more challenging to write than something longer. I mean, you sort of have to get in and out rather quickly.
Well, you know, when I was writing in college, like, I wanted to write these long, long narrative poems, like, just, you know, like, I wanted to be, like, the male Sharon Old. And so I was writing these long narrative poems, and then I wanted them to be in sections, and I just thought, the longer the better, section one, section two, section three. But what comes naturally to me is sort of, like, these lyric poems. Like, they just come, and they are what they are, and they're short, and they're sharp, and it's actually easier for me to do these than the longer pieces. The longer pieces, like, have to be revised to death.
Yeah. I think you're right. And it's interesting that, teaching creative writing for so many years, students don't usually start with a short poem. They have a lot to say, and they want to over-explain things quite a bit, too. And so, you know, usually I find myself in giving feedback, just cutting lines and cutting more lines and cutting more lines and trying to pare it down. And so that's why I think it takes a while, you know, to get to that point where you can write with confidence these short poems. You know, I remember when I'm a big fan of Charles Simic, or Simic, you know, Charles Simic. And when he came out, he won the Pulitzer for, I think, The World Doesn't End, or something like that. Short, little, thin thing, 40 pages, something like that.
Yeah.
And every poem in there was really short.
Right.
But every word mattered, you know.
You have just listened to the first part of our interview with critically acclaimed poet and Savannah State University faculty member, Sajana McRae. Welcome back. I'm your host, Dee Dee Botticelli. Let's listen to the second half of the interview with Sajana McRae, Savannah State University faculty member and the recipient of the 2015 Walt Whitman Award.
I wonder how you feel about this. Is one of the things that draws me to poetry is that, you know, poets are really, really deliberate. And, you know, William Carlos Williams had this thing where he said, you know, a poem is like a well-greased machine. And I don't really like the fact that, you know, machines don't think and such, but I can understand that statement that, you know, every part of that poem has to be there. You take one little thing out, and then the machine doesn't work properly. You know, the message gets lost or something.
Well, you know, when I work with editors and, you know, they cut certain things, like, it takes me a while to sort of understand the edits, like, I'm immediately defensive because I just figure like everything is there for a reason. Sure. And so when things are cut, I'm like, that hurt. And so I have to step back, wait a while, and then take another look. And then I finally understand what they're doing. Because I think I work a lot with sound. You know, if it sounds good to me, then I will use it. But it doesn't necessarily need to be there. I just think it's very tricky. When I revise, I read things over and over and over and over again aloud. Like, it's the only way I can do it. Yeah. I'm using my ear a lot. It's almost like people who are naturally intelligent can make edits quicker. But I have to rely on my ear. And so I'm a little slow. I used being rejected by journals sort of like as a workshop, because after you graduate, you don't have a workshop anymore. So you send these things out, you get them back. They don't put comments on them, but, in my mind, I figure, well, if it didn't make the cut, then maybe I need to revise it some more. So, I was using all of my rejections sort of as workshop.
Sure. That's great.
Yeah.
Or in the rare case that you do get some comments on a rejection, you know, it's almost a publication in itself.
Yeah.
You save those. Oh my God.
Yeah. I have a letter from the New Yorker. Like, it's a rejection letter, but somebody wrote, like, some editor, slush pile editor, wrote at the bottom, "Nice work." And so, like, I framed that letter. Like, I'm just like, I'll never get in there. But, this rejection letter is the best thing ever. Because someone actually wrote, you know, two words on that rejection letter. So I keep that.
That's great. This is great info, too, especially since, you know, part of the purpose of this particular radio program is celebrating our student journal estuary.
Right.
And I really like working with, you know, undergraduate students and getting them to submit their work for the first time. But I feel, too, like I have to be really realistic with them, and I just straight up tell them, I'm like, you know, everybody in this class is going to be rejected. And maybe no one in this class will publish anything this term. And that is completely okay. You know, that is completely okay. Right. But then they're like, well, we don't want to submit then, you know? So it's great that we have the student journal, because we can help them prepare their works and get them up to par so that we can at least get them started in that world by publishing them in estuary. But
right.
Was it like that for you? Can you maybe recount your early days of starting to submit your work to literary journals and that whole...
It's funny, like I think I started off okay. I had gone to Squaw Valley. I had written a poem, with the way that Squaw Valley works is, you know, you have to, like, you can't bring any previous material. So you have to write the poem that night. And so you're like staying up all night and you're like creating something new that they pick up at 7 o'clock in the morning to Xerox for the workshops later that day. So it's really like, so I had written this piece. I had submitted it. Robert Haas was there. I loved Robert Haas. He was like, I don't know. He was like Zeus. He was stunned. He was stunned by that poem. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, you know, it was like I could check that off. I've stunned Robert Haas. And so, you know, I took that poem and I entered it. It won like a contest at Ohio University. It won the AWP Intro Award.
Okay.
And yeah. So, like, I was in, Willow Springs?
Yeah.
And so that was my start. And so, but what I wasn't prepared for was the long, cold winter in the middle where I didn't publish anything. I answered the question for a high school magazine, and I was just like, you know, a lot of times being a writer is about endurance, because you will get rejected a lot, unless you're a genius. I mean, they exist. There are, you know, people who are geniuses, and writing moves in certain fashions. And so, you know, you might not be the fashion of the moment, and you just have to, you know, bear down and just keep writing what you're doing, or keep writing what you write, even if you're not in fashion. I think one of the things that I had to learn is that you have to be smart about the journals that you pick. Like, you have to actually look at the journal and read what's in it before you submit to it, because, you know, your style may not match at all. And, you know, that was my mistake in the beginning. I was just sending out to these, you know, these places that my poetry would not fit in that journal at all. Like, I know that now, but then, you know, I just thought, well, I think it's good, and I just sent it off.
Sure.
But yeah, like, so in the beginning, like, you know, it was okay. Like, I, you know, I was published in that Willow Springs, and then I had a really small poem in, I think, the Black Warrior Review. And then, but that middle section, it was like, it was hard. It was just tough. And then, like, at some point, I started making spreadsheets, you know, to keep track of all the places that, because I was getting crazy. So I was making spreadsheets, and then, you know, color coding it red when I got rejected. And then by the end of the year, it would be like, you know, 3/4 of the sheet is red, and there might be like 2 green bars, which was like, you know, you were accepted. And so, but I kept doing it because, you know, I can't really do anything else. I love teaching. Teaching is probably the next best thing to writing. And so, you know, when I'm not writing, like, you know, I teach. I actually really like being in the classroom with the students. It's odd because in real life, I think I'm really quiet and very shy. But then, you know, when I get into the classroom, you're just like your best self. You know, you're just teaching, and you're talking to the students, and you're actually creating a space. And I just think that's the best thing.
Great. You want to share another poem?
Sure. This poem is called In Need of Subtitles. I wrote this, like, it's gone through lots and lots and lots of different, like, versions. I originally wrote it in graduate school because I had fell in love with a man from Turkey, and it didn't work out, and he played the guitar. So, In Need of Subtitles. Because I can never say anything plainly, because I always stutter politely, because there's always the chatter before the kiss. I want him to know. I'll wait. Like the dames in old MGM films, wrapped in scarves and wisps of cigarette smoke, he turns, smiles, and waves, boards the plane. It's all there in his wrist, the eagerness to go. As the plane turns to make its ascent, my fingers remember the strings, holding the pick in one hand, the idea of strumming in my head. How to make the two connect. As he rumbles away, my cargo as much as the plane's. He moves my wrist, positions my finger with the pick, presses down on the nail determining the note. I think he has a seat by the window, shadow in a body that hovers, face pressed to the glass and kissing my ass goodbye, good riddance. He moves my wrist up and down again and laughs. Enough about guitars, I say. His forearm brushes my fingers, or is it my fingers that brush his forearm? No one ever imagines the tendons as soft, but that's the skin, I suppose. What will he play without me?
Poets, how we just can't escape that. you know, that impulse for sort of love and passion and all of that, yeah.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I was young back then. I was all, you know, it was easy to be sort of enraptured and like caught up, and you know, I don't really do that anymore. Sometimes I wish I could. Like, I wish I was that person who was so just like tuned in to everything. Yeah. But I think, like, as I get older, like, you just have to be cautious if you're, like, overly sensitive to the world. Because I think the older I get, the more prickly the world seems, I think.
Sure. It's experience creeping in, perhaps, you know. The innocence of of youth is going away, and everything, we realize what's happening in the world, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then we start maybe shifting our focus and start writing about that. But, you know, when you're young, your frame of reference is just yourself and your own experience.
Exactly.
It's that big first-person I, you know, and you feel that you're the most, that you are writing the most important poetry in the world. And it's great, because I know that my students feel that way, you know.
No.
And they feel, too, like it's whatever, you know, comes from their pen onto the paper is supposed to be there. And it's sometimes they get offended when you talk revision and things
right.
like that, because they
right.
feel like you're infringing on their experience.
Right.
You know, that
right.
you're trying to minimize their experience, when in actuality you're trying to help them convey it in a better way.
Right.
And
right.
sometimes they'll write these kind of failed attempts at erotica, and I'll joke with them and I'll say, if it was really like that, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe nobody wanted to be a part of that.
Yeah. That's hard.
Yeah.
That's hard. That's very hard. That's difficult. No, I was talking to Tracy K. Smith, and she was saying that, you know, her first book was sort of like the big eye. And then when she started writing her second book was when she started to sort of branch out. And started writing poems from, you know, sort of different, not necessarily focused on, you know, the I.
Yeah, yeah.
And I hope that happens with me. You know, my first book is very, like, I think it's very confessional. I mean, I might as well just say it. Mm-hmm. I think it's very confessional. I think it's very, like, I mean, it's blatantly I. So I hope that, you know, with the second manuscript that it will just... that, you know, I'll change, you know, I'll have a sort of a more, I don't know how to put it, like.
It'll still be I, it'll just be incognito.
Yeah, exactly.
It'll be from the point of
exactly.
view of an animal.
Right.
Or something.
Yeah.
It'll still be you.
Yeah. So I hope so.
That's great. Well, thanks for talking with us. We hope that,
sure.
You know, all successes and future endeavors, and we're looking forward to the next book.
You have just listened to an interview with Sajana McRae, conducted by Dr. Chad Ferries. Also, you heard McRae read two original poems featured in Estuary, Poet of My Father as a Young Black Man and In Need of Subtitles. Thanks to Sajana McRae and Dr. Chad Ferries for joining us at Poetry in the Air. Congratulations, Professor McRae, for the 2015 Walt Whitman Award. The Savannah State University family is very proud of you. Coming up, we'll hear original poems and prose written by our own Savannah State students and alumni. These works will be featured in editions of Estuary, Savannah State University's literary journal.
Hi, I'm Amma Agri. I'm a junior English major, and I'll be reading an original work called Backyard Shortcuts. Fall falls all over the place, disguising itself as golden brown, red-trimmed, and orange leaf-shaped streamers, dancing invisibly around the trunks of assorted color parvite favors. With whipping and bitter motion, drying flesh and wooden spoon mixing hair in its clutches, manipulating all matter not weighed down. With cement or roots or gravity to swirl, to heave in the direction of its smooth salsa, with every step in rubbered sole boots filled with fuzzy socks and skinny leg jeans, dark wash and lightly rugged, a crunch of decay under every footstep, the loose streamers from the branches down on the ground with a mosaic of leaf debris, the snap of twigs crumble under the weight of rigid objects, littered with abandoned tobacco products, glittering with cellophane color wrappers that try to blend to the ground, alone in a place they're not welcomed.
Hello, my name is Jaquim McAllister, and I am a senior journalism and mass comm major, and I will be reading two poems today. The Lonely Dreamer. My friends all live inside my head, my soul was captured by the dead. Sometimes at night I lie in bed, because the truth is on the mess. Palm trees, palm trees, palm trees, I close my palms and pray to die. I wish I was afraid to die. I wish I was afraid to cry. I wish I was afraid to ask why. But then I would be normal, and normal is for the boring. My friends all live inside my head, and when normal is around, they're snoring. The Rearview. Never look back. Instead, have the appetite of a shark, the fight of a dog, but not the bark. Swift as a snake, so they hate to be near you, with the roar of a panther, to make sure that they hear you. The black of the berry, the sweeter the juice too. The lonelier the soul, the deeper the truth too. The bigger the tree, the stronger the roots. The small talker tends to have a big bite. One-on-one, I'll take a dolphin over a shark in a take fight. It's a love-hate thing. They love the way they hate I, but they hate the way they fear I. So if you haven't noticed, it's obvious my screw's loose. My sight is so narrow, the path that I follow, I admire it from my rear view.
You have just listened to original works by SSU students Ama Agri and Jaquin McAllister.
My name is Candace Reynolds. I'm a mass communications major and a graduating senior. I'll be reading my poem, Supposedly. Dear Supposedly, this is to say how sorry I am. I'll be talking to you not knowing if you're still there or if you even still care, since I've lied to you multiple times. I should have never turned my back on you. I should have invested time and came through with my promises. My commitment would be to you in no time, since I don't know when that will be. You used to be my main investment. Now you are no longer a priority. I am sorry for this. After so long of waiting, you're starting to fade away, but I don't blame you. I would have loved to. God gave you to me, and I had to go and mess that up. I gave up, and it hurts, but I'll be all right. I'll have to learn to love you again. Of course, that'll take passion, something I'm not sure that I have anymore. You brought up my confidence and my ego. You sparked my creativity and gave me a list of talents. I have you to thank me for allowing me to be considered for competing in cross-country track runs. It was you that instilled in me the ability to paint lively portraits. It was because of you that I've gotten a standing ovation as I stood center stage in front of a large audience of strangers and sang my heart out. Because of you, I was able to articulate what I wanted to say because I'm too afraid to speak. I was born with you by my side. It was love by choice. You didn't have to choose me, but you did. And now losing you feels like I'm losing my purpose. You had my back from day one and kept giving to me in order to be my mother's success. I was special, and you tried to deliver that message to me through God's will. I was granted you temporarily. I hope that you will return to me one day. Many days I wish that you are not really gone, but rather you took a break from me.
I am Xavier Lampley. I'm a student at Savannah State, and I'm an English major. And I will be reading Went Outside and Saw the Moon, and It Made Me Think of You. I do not love you as if you were the bride, and I'm your groom removing your sheath, or like the ocean kisses the earth's shore, but like the sun loves the moon so much, he dies every night just to let her breathe. You see, I love you much, much more. Saying I love you to the moon and back is such a cliche, and you, my darling, are way more special than that. I love you like the sun still leaves on its light after the moons fade away, and I finally understand why the wolf keeps howling even though the moon never howls back. Till this day, my heart still howls for yours, and each month it cries for a love it will never touch. I try to hold on, but you're slipping away from me like a dying corpse. This is starting to become way too much. I miss you most at night, and I guess I'll never come to grips. See you next solar eclipse.
My name is Macon Bryant. I'm a senior at Savannah State University, and I'll be reading Mama Gave Birth to the Soul Children. Mama gave birth to the soul children. Silence, I'm the future that will never die. All hail the queen. A king and a queen combined, minds and trampled. Walk in the room, they throwing shade left and right. UNITY. And girls, they just want to have fun. Throw your hands up if you know that you're a star. Boy, don't even try to touch this. Girl power, girl power. My persuasion can build a nation. I do it naturally. Superwoman. Even when I'm a mess, I still put an S on my chest. My crown too heavy like the Queen Nefertiti. They call us dirty because we break all your rules. They be like, ooh, she's serving faces.
My name is Tom Bennett, and I am a junior at Savannah State University, and I will be reading 24th March 2015, Dr. Malcolm X, One Beautiful Road, Heaven, God, 00111. Dear Dr. Malcolm X, I just want to say thank you for the way you stood up against racial discrimination. Thank you for always telling it how it was. Thank you for not turning the other cheek, but instead fighting back by any means necessary. Thank you. The Panther and Black Panthers, the H and Huey, the Two and Tupac Shakur, inspirational, intelligent black man, rebel, instilling so much in your people, generation after generation. Your legacy still lives on. Police brutality is still here today. What you said back then still needs to be heard today. Self-defense, protecting our own neighborhoods by any means necessary. Hopefully one day we get our act together. It's a chess game, but we thinking checkers. Trying to play golf instead of playing basketball. There's no I in team. There would have been no dream without the team behind Dr. King, you, and Marcus Garvey. Hopefully you receive my letter. Yours respectfully, Tom Bennett.
Those poems were written and performed by Candace Reynolds, Xavier Lampley, Macon Bryant, and Tom Bennett, all Savannah State University students. Break, and we'll be back with the final portion of the show.
I'm Dr. Lisa Yaunt, the director of the Right Attitude Program at Savannah State University. Here's the writing tip of the day.
Hello, this is Kiara from the Savannah State Writing Center. Just a little writing tip. The structure of an academic paper should be clear and logical. The paper should have a clear introduction and conclusion, and the body paragraph should all support the main point of the paper. Pre-writing and outlining are essential to the creation of good structure in writing.
The Right Attitude Writing Tip of the Day is brought to you by the SSU Writing Center and the Office of the Quality Enhancement Plan. The Right Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative to enhance student learning by improving attitudes about writing. Visit the SSU Writing Center in Payne Hall to get assistance with your writing projects, and to learn more about how you can improve your writing attitudes and skills, visit qep.savannahstate.edu.
Hello, and welcome back to Poetry in the Air, a show dedicated to Estuary, Savannah State University's literary magazine. I'm your host, Dee Dee Botticelli. Please enjoy more original pieces by Savannah State University students. These works appear in either the current volume of Estuary or are forthcoming in the next one.
Janae Waring, Escape to Utopia. Come and hug me with submission of hidden intentions. I can take all your pressures and weight of the world. Stretch your body all around me and hold on for dear life. I can take you on a journey through so many worlds. Change your perspective, changing your ongoing doubt of the world into gooey thoughts, knowledgeable truth. You can't run from me, but run to me with the speed of a bolt. I stay on the minds of every single student rushing to class. Oh, how much I'm needed and missed through the daily tasks of the day. You're at risk of never having comfort because you lack the substance of life. You feed off what I give you in a parasitical way. I give you life, and you just take, take, take. But when you're not here, I have no shape. Flat and cast land waiting to be conquered, the great escape.
My name is Brittany Johnson. I'm a junior, English major. I will be reading Life Too Short. Life Too Short to be outraged for hunger. The hunger at love, care at timid. Let alone, so why this, why her, just leave because feelings are so gone. What happened, happened, nothing at all. Must I move forward, for you I will. Now that the storm has ended, I spread my wings. I thank you all, for you, for the lesson. No one once ever laughed at my paper again. The past I have buried, for a new angel has risen upon me. I, the creation of a new charm, part of gold to the end of his rainbow. Call me Trap Queen. The K has won a special trophy. So to be honest, I tell you the truth. No more pain, no more worries. You should have known better. I say to you, don't ever say my name. All that pain has faded away.
My name is Quianna Levant, and I am a senior here at Savannah State University, and I will be reading Much Obliged. To whom I am much obliged, to you, sir, whom I owe my heart, surfing your love like a tide. Oh, what an amazing ride. To whom I am much obliged, to you, sir, whom I owe my soul, the taste of your tender kiss is the very thing I wish to still behold. To whom I am much obliged, to you, sir, whom I gave my body, because I don't owe you anything, because I eventually found you to be too cowardly. To whom I was much obliged, to you, sir, whom I gave my all, I should have known better, I should have been more careful than to fall. To whom I was much obliged, to you, sir, who took it all, I see you aren't so tough now, not to player to get down, beg, and crawl.
Hi, my name is Jeremy Little. I'm a junior here at Savannah State University, and today I will be reading a piece, Live to Play the Game, by Tiffany Taylor. I was born into the game. I live and breathe the dirt-filled air that blows in the wind. The smell of crisp-cut grass fills my lungs. While the heat from the sun beams down on my face, I slip in and out of focus. I am beyond exhaustion. My veins are filled with adrenaline, giving fuel to my ligaments as I mentally prepare for the next play. I glance over at my coach, who is in his own zone. I can see a strategic machine churning in the depths of his thoughts. Hope fills his eyes. Determination drives his decision. One false move, and the whole game could take a turn. Yet thriving off pressure, he makes the call. The soles of my feet throb in pain above the spikes holding me above the ground. The sweat has gathered and settled above my eyebrows. As the dirt is collected upon my cheeks after several dives and slides into the red clay, my shoulders are burnt and peeling will begin soon. It's been hours upon hours of a grueling battle. Victory is its reward if we are to make it to the end as victors. The finish line is approaching rapidly, but seems so far away. If only I could fast forward to the end, to the part where we're screaming hysterically, running around like wild animals, throwing up our gear in the air, and chest bumping my players as we run into the center field. But at this very moment, reality has set in. Time seems to be at a standstill. My counterparts around me look tired and worn to the grain. At this moment, I must find it within myself and place the weight of my teammates on my shoulders and will them to complete what we have come so far to achieve. Hours upon hours of practice, along with 6 a.m. conditioning and weight training each week in order to train our bodies. These are the moments we prepare for. These are the moments in life we thrive off of. There are many things in life that are fulfilling and satisfying, but there's nothing like fighting to the teeth to defeat your opponent. He said you out. He said you out. We scream to the top of our lungs, chanting and terrorizing our opponents after each out. 2 outs, bottom of the top of the 7th, 1 run lead, and we need 1 more out to seal the deal. The pitcher fires the first pitch. The batter fouls it off. She has the look of determination in her eyes. She would want nothing more than to drive the ball clear across the fence to silence the cheers and shouting outside the fence. She winds up for the next pitch, ball 1. I begin to pace myself, and I place myself in the shoes of the batter. How bad would I want to send that ball right back down the pitcher's throat? With the count 1-1, she throws the next pitch, pow! The shot to center field. I watch the ball fly through the air, praying God stops its flight, knowing my opponent is probably praying the very opposite of my wishes. As I watch the ball fly over my head, I cry out my center fielder's name as loud as I possibly can, hoping she gets to the ball on time. I felt as though I paused time. Everything began to move in slow motion. As she sprints to the ball, she leaps off the ground and throws her body in the air, and she dives headfirst for the ball. As her body collides with the ground, the ball settles into the cup of her glove. Sliding across the grass, I screamed like my insides were trying to escape my body, leaving me short of breath. Bum rushing her, in center field, we all piled up one after another in excitement. Smiles filled our faces while sadness swarms our opponent's dugout. Disbelief and hurt rushes into their hearts as they hang their heads down in defeat. Watching this display of victorious celebration was like having a sharp knife plunged into their backs. We collect ourselves and we join at the plate as we shake hands of our competitors and look them in the eye and thank them for a great opportunity to compete against a great team. Gathering our things together, we walk to our locker room, singing our famous victory song from Remember the Titans, while accepting a beautiful round of applause from our family and friends who await us outside the gates. We sit in our lockers as we take off what I like to call our battle uniforms, along with the dirt and grime collected on our jerseys, the sweat and blood dripping from our bodies. We remove our coats of honor and put it into its rest for another day. Coach motions us to quiet down so he can give his post-game speech. What a way to come out and play the game hard, ladies. Hand claps fill the room, and we all look around at one another in gratitude. I am proud of all of you, and I hope that we can continue on this road of success. I don't see anyone beating us again after a victory like today. You played like champions, and for that, I am proud of you. Coach stares down at the ground while he collects his thoughts. To know that his team has accomplished a great defeat over one of the most forceful rivals in the region is an amazing feeling. Like a proud father, his girls have finally risen to the occasion and played like the champions he knew they could be. This game is not only a game to be played by a girl that's an athlete, or to be played by a girl that loves the game of softball. It is to be played by a young girl that wants to blossom into a woman of great poise, honor, and courage. It is to be played by someone that is driven by emotions and thrives off the idea of defeat. The lessons learned out on the field are lifelong and blessings in disguise. There's nothing like the sisterhood you gain by being a member of a united softball team. From arguments to screaming matches of disagreements, every emotion is left out on the field. I look over to my left at someone I trust and I have faith will do a job. I look over to my left and I see someone willing to put her body on the line for me and her teammates. The relationships that are developed on the field are everlasting. There's a level of respect gained from your peers when you're willing to go all out, not just for yourself, but for your team. I admire my surrounding sisters. They are wonderful individuals. We may look different from the outside, but we all share a common heart. We all have the same line of blood pumping through our veins. There's a silent understanding among each of us that protects us from the outside world. And I would never let anyone or anything hurt one of my family members. The greatest thing of all about being part of a team is never going through anything in life alone again. Memories will guide you along the way, while lessons you've learned will steer you on your journey of your chosen direction. As you round the bases of that journey, you'll have the team you can truly call your girls.
The last set featured Janae Waring, Brittany Johnson, Kiana Levant, and a work of prose by Tiffany Taylor, read by Jeremy Little. We've once again come to the end of our show. I hope you've enjoyed another installation of Poetry in the Air. If you are interested in learning more about Estuary, please contact Dr. Chad Ferries in the Savannah State University Department of English, Languages, and Cultures. Don't forget that you can always listen to all of the Right Attitude radio shows by visiting the Quality Enhancement Plan website, qep.savannahstate.edu. I would like to thank our production team, Professors Chad Ferries and Ryan Clark, our QEP team, Lisa Yont, Adriana Oliveira, and Sierra Walton, as well as WHCJ's Ike Carter and Grace Curry. Special thanks also goes out to acclaimed poets Maria Hadessa Ekeritali, Noah Blaustein, Shole Wolpe, Sajana McCrae, and Savannah State University students. I'm your host, Didi Botticelli. See you next time, and remember, embrace your inner author.